case 95-1628, Stewart State versus Heriberto Castillo. Mr. Finley, representing the petitioner, Mr. Castillo.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Pete Finley, and I represent the defendant, appellant petitioner, Heriberto Castillo, Jr. Mr. Castillo was found to be a juvenile delinquent when he was 14, based upon the finding that he, a victim himself of child sexual abuse within his family, had had sexual intercourse with his younger sister when he also was a child. Shortly before his release from juvenile custody, when he was 18, the state petitioned under Chapter 980 to have him committed as a sexually violent offender. Mr. Castillo waived his trial rights and admitted the allegations in the Chapter 980 petition based on the state's promise of supervised release, a promise and understanding that had infused this case from its inception. The examining experts, the parties, and the court agreed that community placement was the least restrictive and most appropriate treatment placement. But the state ultimately did not keep its promise. After months of efforts to place him in the community, the state and then the court gave up. Although the record shows that placements that would meet Mr. Castillo's treatment and supervision needs do exist in the community, they are reserved for other population groups, such as the mentally ill under Chapter 51, the developmentally disabled under Chapter 55, NGI acquittees under 971-17, and convicted felons released on parole or mandatory release still under supervision.
But none of these placements would have sufficed for him. In other words, those people are placed and there is acceptance here. The state tried, as I understand, and then they were rejected, right? Could you expand on that a little bit? Because one of the rejections was, I know, the Cephas House, and the other was an individual placement in an apartment, but that the state eventually withdrew from those, right?
That's correct. Cephas House is a Department of Corrections halfway house. That is, right. It's a halfway house for convicted felons on their way out of
the prison. Run by the Lutheran Social Services.
Right, run on a contract with Lutheran Social Services. That's correct. They had tried to get Mr. Castillo into that placement, but because the facility had a private landlord and was in a zoning area that restricted it, they ultimately decided they could not accommodate sex offenders in that halfway house. The court also looked to placing him in a private apartment with supervision by a private social worker, along with electronic monitoring and supervision by the Department of Probation and Parole. But that fell through when, again, community hostility pressured the landlord into refusing to lease to Mr. Castillo. The important point from this, though, is that what we see from this is that, in fact, there are placements in the community that can accommodate Mr. Castillo. In this case, the state just was not able to or did not follow through sufficiently to make sure that he got into one of these placements. This is not a case where his supervision needs exceeded what was possible in the community. These placements were possible. They just wouldn't take him. And so it's our position that that is not a sufficient reason to deny an individual what he's entitled to under the terms of Chapter 980, under the Constitution, and under the orders and findings of the Circuit Court. If the state is serious about committing and treating individuals such as this, and serious about providing treatment in the least restrictive setting, including in the community when appropriate, it must follow through and provide those placements. In this case, it lacked the will, the resolve, to create whatever it took to get him into a placement.
Mr. Finley, should we have taken this case given the Neely decision? Quite obviously, one of the things that you asked for with the Court of Appeals was a reversal. And it's my understanding, looking at the mandate from the Court of Appeals, that that is what you got. You got a reversal. You got a remand to the trial court. Given the holding of this court in Neely, should we have taken this case?
I believe that your decision to take this case is entirely consistent with the Neely decision. In the Court of Appeals, we asked for three things. First, we asked that the court throw the case out because it violates the Constitution, or at least that the court order the state to find a community placement for Mr. Castillo as required by Chapter 980 and by the Constitution. That was our primary request for relief. In the alternative, we said, if the court's not going to do that, he's at least entitled to withdraw his plea. And that's what the court seized on, ruled on that, did not rule on the other two issues. Neely says that one may not petition to the Supreme Court for review if one prevails in the Court of Appeals, but simply disagrees with the rationale of the Court of Appeals. Instead, one may petition the Supreme Court if one disagrees with the outcome of the case. And that is precisely what we've done here. We didn't get the outcome we really asked for.
I was just going to say, outcome is your word, your argument. I didn't see outcome in Neely. Now, maybe I missed it, but is it there?
I'd have to look again at the specific...
Well, Neely uses the words decision, result, disposition, or mandate. Do you see a difference between result and outcome? We debated this case last year. That's why there's...
Not on this issue.
Right? Not on this issue, but whether there was a difference in result and outcome.
Thank you.
don't worry about it.
I'll stick with any of those that the Chief Justice is...
Well, I copied that right from Neely. It says that you have to appeal from the decision, and then it defines decision to mean result, disposition, or mandate. And I'm reading from page 58. I'll just count in a second. Thus, the opinion explains the result reached by the court. The word decision is used in the statutes and the rules refers to the result, paren, or disposition, or mandate, paren, reached by the Court of Appeals in the case. That's the exact language.
Well, let's go back to that then. Using result, using mandate, using decision, you got one of the things you asked for. You asked that the case go back, that you be allowed to withdraw your client's plea. Isn't that right?
We got part of what we asked for. We got one alternative what we were asked for, but we did not get what we asked for chiefly.
But that happens all the time, counsel. A plaintiff in a losing case appeals to the Court of Appeals, and they maybe three different rulings of the trial court, and they don't get two of them, but they get the third. We don't normally take those cases, do we?
I think...
If the plaintiff says, well, I only got one third of the loaf, but I want the whole loaf.
I'm not sure what specific facts you're referring to there, but I think it is appropriate for this court to take a case where the party says, this is what I really want, and they get an adverse decision from that in the Court of Appeals. Remember, that's what we're appealing from, is an adverse decision. And we got an adverse decision by refusing to grant us the relief we wanted.
Well, let me ask you, it seems to me that there does appear to be a difference between, if your argument had been with what you say you were really asking for, and I understand that was your primary argument, that the community placement be enforced somehow, or there be a dismissal. If you'd not asked for a vacation of the plea and the court then had done it, the Court of Appeals, it seems to me that your argument would be stronger, saying that's not one of the remedies we asked for. We didn't ask for that mandate of vacating the plea. But when it's one, and I understand you have to make those strategic choices, but when you, one of the three things you asked for was that, I understand it may have been an alternative argument, but you got what you asked for, at least on the alternative argument. And that's the concern, at least, that I have in terms of saying, you asked for it, and the Court of Appeals gave it to you. And now you're appealing and saying, well, we really wanted the other.
I'm not sure what sense it would make to say that we can't ask for things in the alternative, that if we ask for things...
I don't think you should say that. The question is whether you can appeal for them when you get it.
Well, but the effect of that would be to say, if you can't appeal, if you get your alternative relief, then what you're telling me is, if I really want my primary relief, I can't ask for alternative relief. And therefore, what you're telling me is, I can pick one issue, one form of relief, and I can't present to the court other options, because if I do, I'm going to, and I win on the one I don't really want, I've waived my right to actually ask for what I do.
But doesn't that then encourage appellate lawyers in the Court of Appeals to put up all sorts of issues? And even though they may win on most of them, they may lose on one or two, as Justice Babbage pointed out, and say, well, we didn't, you know, or I won on this one, but I lost on these. So we have petitioners up here all the time who, in fact, won a great deal with the Court of Appeals, but not exactly what they wanted, or not all of their issues. I mean, that's the concern.
Well, I understand that. I think that that's probably not going to be a real problem. Because, for one thing, a good appellate lawyer is going to be thinking about what are the strong issues to present and not throwing out a whole smorgasbord. But beyond that, when we petitioned for review in this case, we did so knowing that we were taking a risk to do so. Because by petitioning for review on the issues we really wanted, we knew we were subjecting to the other issue to a cross-petition and the possibility of losing that win as well. So there's a built-in restraint on that. What we're all we're really doing is saying, let's let this court and the parties have a full and fair opportunity to consider what's the real heart of the case, without telling the parties that they can only get to the real heart if they're willing to get rid of all of the other possible fallback positions that they might have.
So, Mr. Findlay, another thing that concerns me about the fact that we took this case is the state of the record. Because of the plea agreement, you never put in any evidence nor cross-examined any witnesses with respect to the primary issue of whether or not your client is a sexual predator under 980. Isn't that correct?
The defense never presented any witnesses. There was a doctor's report requested by the defense that the court considered. There was testimony at the probable cause hearing, and their defense did cross-examine that witness. So there was some evidence.
Well, are you willing to concede for purposes of this case that your client is a sexual predator under 980?
For purposes of this appeal, he's already conceded that. He has already conceded that.
But the state of the record is that that the plea agreement has been wiped out, and at least as the case comes to us, your client is prepared to stand trial, is supposed to be standing trial. And yet for us to write a decision in this case, it seems to me we have to say that your client is a sexual predator.
Yes, but for that purpose, he is willing to accept a finding that he's a sexually violent offender.
So it's an advisory opinion. It's an advisory opinion. We're saying, assuming. We have to make the assumption, correct? We cannot state it as a matter of fact.
No, you can. I think you can state it as a matter of fact, because what he's doing is saying, give me my primary relief, don't allow me to withdraw my plea if you give me my primary relief, in which case his admission that he entered in the trial court goes back into effect. It's not advisory, it is in fact an admission that he made in the trial court that he's willing to allow the court to keep if it gives him his primary form of relief.
Mr. Findlay, what's wrong with him going back and having a trial? What's the problem with that?
Well, the problem, which I think the Court of Appeals acknowledged, and I think the Attorney General also acknowledged in the oral argument in the Court of Appeals, is that may not solve the problem. If we go back and have a trial, there is a likelihood, a possibility, I don't know how to evaluate how strong it is, that he will be committed again. If he is committed again, then we're right back where we started, and we've solved nothing, because there still is no community placement available, and he's right back in that same limbo. He is willing to accept a finding that he's a sexually violent offender. He's really willing to accept a commitment. He's willing to accept supervision. He wants the...
But only if he's in the community.
The one thing he doesn't want is to be confined, is to be locked up in a Type 1 prison any longer. And that's why this is his primary issue. That's his primary form of relief that he's seeking.
Mr. Findlay, are there other cases like your clients where there's been an order for the least restrictive alternative, that is community supervision, that you know? Or is your client unique?
No, there have been other orders for community placement. I do know that. I don't know how many or what their circumstances are. But I am aware that he is not alone in that regard.
When you say he's not alone, you mean those other cases are somewhere in the appellate pipeline?
I don't know. I'm sorry to say I don't know where they are, because all I know is that there are other cases where individuals the courts have ordered supervised release.
Do you know of any cases in which this court has accepted a petition for review and then eventually ruled on the case in which the prevailing party is the petitioner? The party who asked, who received at least part of what they wanted?
I don't know off the top of my head.
Did you look into it?
I did not look into that specific issue, and I would be happy to look into it and provide the court with supplemental memorandum.
Here's the case that I think might be the answer. And what you have to do is look for a result that is partially favorable to the party that petitions. And the one I thought about, but I haven't checked through our own systems, is a civil case where the plaintiff wins at the trial court. At the Court of Appeals, the plaintiff is ordered to have a new trial. So a new trial is better than losing. right, totally, and having a reversal. And I think that we've taken cases where the plaintiff complains about a new trial, which is a win, a partial win.
But if the plaintiff wins at the trial court level, then the defendant is the petitioner.
At the Court of Appeals.
At the Court of Appeals.
The defendant then gets...
The defendant prevails if there's a new trial order.
That's right. But so does the plaintiff, in a sense that they get part of the loaf. Plaintiff says, don't reverse entirely. I mean, I think you ought to affirm the trial court, but if you don't affirm, I want a new trial. So, anyway, try that. That's the one I could think of as a possibility.
Again, what I think it comes down to is how you define a win. And
that's right.
This was not a win for us in the Court of Appeals in the way we presented it, what we were really looking for. And I can't, to be honest, I can't think of any reason, as a matter of policy or as a matter of interpretation of Neely, why this court would want to say that you can't litigate the issue that you really wanted to win on, and why this court would say we can't even consider that issue, especially when it's of such important significance to the settlement of this Chapter 980 issues.
The Attorney General, in his brief, pointed out a number of cases in which that would cause great problems.
It seemed to me that all of the examples the Attorney General pointed out were cases in which the Attorney General's complaint was not with the decision, not with the mandate, but with the rationale of the court.
So let me ask you, maybe we need supplemental briefs on this, but let's take a criminal case where a defendant appeals on the basis of a denial of a motion to suppress evidence and also a request for new trial based on other alleged errors during trial. And at the Court of Appeals level, the defendant prevails on the new trial motion but loses on the motion to suppress whatever evidence it was. The question then is, can the defense ask for petition this court for review on the motion to suppress, even though it got obtained a new trial?
That's a close question, and I'm not really sure what the answer to that is, because in one sense they didn't get what they asked for, but in another sense that does fit under Neely, because what they got was a new trial, which they would be asking for if they were moving to suppress. Perhaps a better example might be this. Suppose a defendant appeals claiming insufficient evidence and an evidentiary issue and asking the alternative, reverse and remand for a new trial. But my primary claim for release is there was insufficient evidence. I'm entitled to an acquittal and dismissal. And the Court of Appeals says, well, we're going to grant you, we're going to rule against you on that, but we're going to grant you a new trial. The defendant has lost. And it seems to me they won part of it, but they didn't win what they really wanted. They should be able to petition to this court and say, hey, the evidence was insufficient. I shouldn't have to go back for a new trial. It seems to me that's a closer analogy.
It's a civil case. That's the same example. And I think that's what... And I think you're going to find it in the civil cases. I think you're going to find them take them. Not all of them, but I will ask...
Another example might be an excessive sentence and a new trial motion in winning one, losing the new trial motion... But winning resentencing, and although they may have been both requested, the defendant tried to petition on a new trial issue.
Exactly.
Mr. Finley, if we were to adopt your approach, how would you define the new rule that this court should enunciate? What would you say our mandate should be here?
Are you talking about the rule as to when the court should grant petitions for review?
Exactly. Exactly.
I think the rule should be what I read Neely to say already, which is that the court can grant petitions for review whenever there's an adverse decision against an individual in the Court of Appeals, which means that the individual in the Court of Appeals did not get the mandate, result, decision, outcome, whatever the term is, that they were primarily seeking in that court. If they did not get the mandate they were looking for, then they should be able to petition.
So if it wasn't their first choice, but they got some other relief they requested, we should let them come up here anyway.
If in fact, their first choice was what they were seeking primarily and would have disposed of all of the other issues, would have resolved the case, then yes, I think so.
Well, does it make any difference that there's an argument that this issue will revisit it, will come up in this case in the near future? In your test for Neely, you indicate if there's an adverse result, mandate, outcome. But the state responds with some kind of a floodgate argument. You know, we're going to have all sorts of encouraging litigation and encouraging appeals. Does it make any difference in this, in your or shouldn't make any difference, that we have a case here that is ongoing, that it's a new, it's being sent back for further proceedings. And it seems Judge Brown suggests that we're going to be having this case anyway. Does that enter into the elements or the extension of Neely?
Well, I think it certainly can. I mean, this court often reviews issues that it wouldn't review otherwise because it's in a matter of judicial economy to handle the matter, or because it's important to resolve the matter so it can give guidance to the trial courts on remand. It's that type of analogy, I think, that would suggest that, yes, this is a particularly appropriate type of case in which to grant review, because it is ongoing, and because, as Judge Brown pointed out, this sending it back for a new trial probably isn't going to solve the problem, probably isn't going to resolve it. This seems to me to be a particularly effective use of judicial resources to go ahead and take this case.
Mr. Finley, the court's questioned you for about 20 minutes of your time on a procedural, very important procedural issue, because that's not jurisdictional, but almost jurisdictional. Nevertheless, you have two other arguments other than the plea agreement. Let's forget the plea agreement argument for the moment. You've got an argument that relates to the circuit court's powers versus the department's and a constitutional as applied issue. I suggest you pick one, at least.
Okay, I will try to very quickly summarize my positions on those. It's my position that the statute mandates this release because the trial court found that the supervised release is the most appropriate and least restrictive placement, and that, as the record shows in this case, what I was alluding to earlier, there are these types of placements. There's no showing of exorbitant cost. There's no showing that it's not feasible, that it can't be done. What the record shows is this can be done. The state just has not exercised the will to do it in this case. It can be done for other populations. There's no reason why it can't be done. The state just has not exercised the will to stand up to the public hostility, to allocate the appropriate resources, to create the placements that make this necessary, that make this possible. Even the DHSS, in opposing this placement, agreed that it was possible, but that they just don't have any such facilities for this, for individuals under Chapter 980. And it seems to me that that's not a sufficient reason to deny the placement. It's very, very brief, but I want to touch on the constitutional issue because there's a new development in the constitutional argument, which I should probably address briefly, and that is the United States Supreme Court's decision in the Kansas versus Hendricks case. As I'm sure the court is aware, the U.S. Supreme Court in Hendricks ruled that a sexual predator statute from the state of Kansas is constitutional. That statute does not have supervised release provisions, but I want to explain to the court why that does not dispose of the constitutional claims in this case. And that is because the Kansas statute and the Wisconsin statute are different in a number of significant respects. The question under the ex post facto and double jeopardy clause is whether the statute is punitive in nature or effect. And in looking at the Kansas statute, the U.S. Supreme Court looked at a number of specific factors that it identified as indicating that that statute was not punitive. Those factors are different than some of the elements of the Wisconsin statute. For instance, the U.S. Supreme Court found it very significant that the Kansas commitments are not indefinite. The commitments there are for 1 year, and they expire at the end of each year, and then the state, if it wants to keep the individual longer, must initiate recommitment proceedings. That's different than Wisconsin. The Wisconsin commitments are indefinite. The individual may petition for release, but the onus is on the defendant to petition, and the state's burden is lesser at those recommitment proceedings. In addition, the Supreme Court focused on such things as these legislatures' express statement in the Kansas statute that statute was civil, and its placement of that statute within the civil probate code rather than the criminal code. Those two features are absent from the Wisconsin statute. So, because the Wisconsin statute doesn't say it's a civil commitment and puts it in the criminal statutes. So there are some elements of the Wisconsin statute that make it appear more punitive. So it was important when this court relied on the supervised release provisions and the least restrictive setting placement options. That was an important component that counterbalanced those other features of the Kansas statute to show that the Wisconsin statute is not unduly punitive.
Mr. Finley, why aren't you arguing that failure of the state to follow its own statute violates due process?
Well, actually, that argument has occurred to me in preparing for the argument. It was one that I just hadn't developed before, and I think that is another compelling argument. I see that my time has expired, so I'll have to stop there. Thank you.
And you've got 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Mr. Weinstein, Assistant Attorney General representing the state.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The main point that I think I want to make, at least on the merit of this case, is that this record does not establish that Mr. Castillo was denied a supervised release because of funding.
Could you speak up, please?
I'm sorry.
I heard that, but I make sure you speak up.
This case does not establish that Mr. Castillo was denied supervised release because of funding. Ms. Harris specifically testified that funding was available. The problem was, and I disagree with Mr. Finley's reading of the record in this case, there were no facilities, including criminal facilities, that had sufficient supervision for this particular defendant's needs. Most of the criminal defendants do not require 24-hour supervision. They do not require observation by people trained in sex offender behavior awareness. And for those reasons, he was not able to be placed in a criminal facility, even if there were contractual problems, which there were. Mr. Finley's correct about that. But that was not the only barrier to Mr. Castillo's placement in a criminal halfway house. Cephas House is a criminal halfway house. The department had made arrangements to pay Cephas House to hire additional staff to make physical changes in the buildings just for Mr. Castillo. Now, the state did not withdraw from that placement. The court ordered the placement, and the placement was unable to be carried through because Cephas House refused to comply. They came into court and explained to the judge why they would not take him. That was not at the behest of the state. That was at the behest of Cephas House. Likewise, Mr. Patrick's placement was ordered, funded. He rented a place. It fell through, not because the state did anything and not because Mr. Castillo did anything. It fell through because of the community hostility. Mr. Patrick testified there was no place in the state where Mr. Castillo could be placed. He investigated places as far away as the Far North.
Hurley.
I'm sorry?
Hurley.
Yes, Hurley. Thank you. There just wasn't any place that met this particular defendant's needs. Now, that does not mean that all persons found to be sexual offenders are going to have these same kind of needs and it cannot be met. There are a few offenders who have been placed on supervised release. Mr. Castillo, not so much because of the nature of his sexual offenses, but because of his particular supervisory needs, was a difficult case to place.
What made it difficult?
The fact that he needed 24-hour supervision.
Why would, I'm reading the reports of the doctors, they don't make reference to 24-hour supervision. It seemed to me like a standard run-of-the-mill report with regard to supervision. It's DHSS that talks about 24 hours. Am I correct or incorrect?
Well, Dr. Mays refers to close monitoring by clinically trained professionals who can identify high-risk behaviors of sexual offenders. That's quoted from pages 4 and 5 of my brief, and it's in the document of 11, which is difficult to cite because there are several documents in an envelope. Dr. Kotkin said he had to have substantial and close amount of monitoring. Now, substantial is not a definitive word, but that indicates quite a bit of supervision. It was because of this particular defendant's background, his family history, was quite unusual, I guess would be the kindest way to say it.
But when I hear close monitoring of his activities in the community by clinicians who are trained to identify high-risk behaviors of sex offenders, participation in sex offender group therapy with additional individual therapy if necessary, training in how to take care of himself as independent adults.
And that was one of the problems with
This doesn't translate into 24-hour continuous visual supervision.
Well, I think the evidence establishes that it does. And I would also point out to the court that it is not for the court to determine the level of supervision in this statute. What constitutes least restrictive placement within the category of supervised release is given to the department, not to the court.
On what do you base that, Mr. Weinstein?
That is the language in 980.062B, I believe it is. The order of commitment, that's the court's order, under this section, shall specify either institutional care in a secure mental health facility or supervised release, period. The last sentence then says, the department shall arrange for care, control, and treatment of the person in the least restrictive manner consistent with the requirements of the person and in accordance with the court's commitment order. Now, as I read that, what that says is the court decides between supervised release and secure mental health facility. Once the court makes that decision, the level of security within those two is left to the department.
Why did the department in this case stipulate or agree to community placement rather than inpatient treatment?
Well, perhaps because of the fact that this was one of the early cases, there was not as good communication between the district attorney and the Department of Health and Family Services as there should have been, because the district attorney made that agreement, and then when the department went to try to implement what ended up being the court's order, they couldn't find a facility that had sufficient supervisory restrictions to satisfy the needs of public safety.
Let me tell you what my problem is. My problem is that clearly this court upheld the constitutionality of the sexual predator law based on the fact that this is meant to be a treatment statute and not punitive. And of the two statutes you just read to us, it appears that the trial court, has the ultimate decision of whether this is a community-based treatment release or whether it's an inpatient in custody kinds of release. And then after that, the department decides the level of supervision and the placement. And it appears here, at least from the record that I've read, the state agreed with the defense all along that this was going to be, the recommendation was going to be, that the placement be outside of the institution, on a formal institution. The court was presented with that agreement, did not reject the agreement up front, and in fact did not reject the agreement later on, and continued to voice its opinion that the defendant ought to be in the community. Clearly the right of the court to make that decision. And then the department says, well, we don't have anything, and, you know, whether or not it had to be 24 hours, we can't do it. And it seems to me it turns the whole statute upside down, because the department says, sorry, judge, you may have that option, but you don't have it here. We can't comply, so therefore you have to put the offender in custody situation, which seems to turn it all upside down. And so that's my concern.
In this case, that's what looks like happened, and probably is what did happen, because the district attorney was unaware of what was out in the community, just as the court was. But there were a few indications of that this was going to happen before the court accepted the plea and before the court made the order.
But doesn't this give the control to the department then as to whether there's going to be an inpatient in custody kind of order, or whether there's going to be a community release? Because ultimately, if they come in and say, look, this guy needs 24 hours a day and we can't give it in the community, judge, you have no options here.
Well, I don't think so, because as I read the statute, what's supposed to happen is that the department is supposed to make the community facilities in the county of residence.
Well, what if they came in here and said, we have nothing available. We don't have any facilities. The couple of places we found, the publicity is so bad, we can't do anything, Judge. So you may order it, but we don't know what to do with this guy. Does the judge then not have the discretion or the option to order outpatient treatment or community release based on what the department tells the judge? I mean, this seems to me then the discretion's taken away from the court, and the department is ultimately determining on how much money they spend on facilities and what's available in the community. And they can just go in and say, sorry, we don't have any placements, so if you release them, we can't supervise them.
To the extent that there are no facilities for a particular defendant, I think that perhaps is true. The problem is that what that does is it presupposes that there is a constitutional right to treatment in a particular place. Because when this court decided that the statute was non-punitive based on treatment, it didn't say because, and the treatment has to be in the community.
The problem, I don't hear an argument that it may be underneath it all a constitutional right to treatment in a certain place, but here the record clearly reflects at least the district attorney's office who represents Waukesha County, the defense lawyer who represented Mr. Castillo and the court all believed that an outpatient community release was appropriate. And based on the lack of facilities, it just...
Well, I would still disagree that it was based on the lack of facilities. The court made an order. DHSS got an appropriate placement, and the placing facility, Cephas House, backed out. The court made another order. The department funded it, and because of the landlord in that case, it was unable to be...
Well, isn't that going to ultimately be the problem with every sexual predator?
Well,
there's going to be a request and a look to put a sexual predator into the community, there's going to be a public outcry because nobody's going to want them next door. And facilities are going to say, look, we don't want the flack, we don't want the problem. And so the department's going to have to come in and say, we can't find any place because nobody will take them because of the public outcry.
Where's the state action there? The state hasn't done anything. It's the private individual.
Well, but the state tried. I don't know how many times the state has to try, but there's a legislation, and if we interpret it the way the defendant asks, we interpret your way, that's the end of it, right?
I'm sorry?
We interpret this statute the way you request in your briefs and at oral argument. Then the state can say you get treatment in an institutional basis, right? And that's it. If we
for this individual, that may be correct, but there are supervised releases. I don't think a decision by this court that Mr. Castillo's placement means that every sex predator is not going to be... is going to be denied supervised release.
Well, how do you then distinguish? This court and the medical evidence seem to indicate he can be outside in the community, supervised, but outside. And yet, that's not what the department's giving him. So
this particular defendant?
Yes.
I think this particular defendant's needs are unique.
What makes it unique? It sounds to me like he'd be maybe one of, if you had a 1 to 10, he'd be a 5.
Well,
in terms of violence,
I mean,
in terms
this is,
of...
This is a guy that, in an institution, committed a sexual assault. I mean, I don't... I think that makes him somewhat unique. Even in the structured setting of an institution, Ethan Allen, he committed a sexual assault.
What was that assault?
I'm sorry?
What was that assault?
There were actually... I don't know the correct term for it, the rubbing up against the nurse. He also committed an assault it wasn't a state institution, but it was a private juvenile facility. That was sorry, I don't see the name of it. He was in a facility prior to his transfer to Ethan Allen. And the reason for his transfer to Ethan Allen was a sexual assault in that facility. So, I mean, here's a guy that even under a really structured setting is having some problems with acting out.
And I assume the judge heard that, the trial court judge.
Certainly it was in both in the reports,
okay.
And it was also in Dr. May's testimony. And it was also in, I believe, the testimony of the at the probable cause hearing by the psychologist from Ethan Allen.
Let me just add, I just want to make sure my memory is correct to the record. What you're referring to is that he bumped up or touched up against a nurse, and that he admitted in his counseling and talking that, in fact, he had sexual fantasies by virtue of his touching clothing to clothing.
There was nothing in the record
that even the nurse was aware of that.
That's right. That was at Ethan Allen.
Yes, that was referred to as brushed up against. That's the sexual assault you're saying he committed?
Well, it was an unprevented contact, and I mean, it would meet the statutory criteria.
That was my point.
I didn't write it.
That may very well be a sexual assault. It's not quite the same as other sexual assaults.
Well, it's actually a sexual contact, rather.
Right. In terms of a danger to the community. Not that I'm in favor of unwanted touching.
I understand, but the reason I bring that up is that it happened in an extremely structured setting.
Right.
And it's consistent with others have said are the fantasies that this man experiences.
According to what he told the psychologist, yes.
But I come back to the same issue that Justice Bradley raised. So what's so unique about him? You've got somebody, again, whose behavior should not be condoned, who has, for purposes of these hearings, said, okay, I'm under Chapter 980, you can treat me. But what's so unique about him compared to somebody who had a rape and who was still violent or... doctors would say still has an inclination towards violence and needs to be, can be in the community, but has to have structured care.
Well,
I mean, that's a worst case.
I don't think it's the worst case. I'm sure that there are other people who have similar supervisory needs, but I also think that there are a good number of people who are committed under the statutes who don't have those difficult needs.
Let me just ask you this. What is, should you prevail? How do you want the court to interpret 980.06? I think it's too big.
Are you referring to the...
I'm referring to the placement.
Is it 2A or B?
Well, you can give me either one, but I think B, which is what you've been talking about, in determining whether commitment should be for institutional care in a secure mental health unit or facility or other facility or for supervised release, the court may consider blah, 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 and then you rely on the last sentence, which says the department shall arrange for controlled care and treatment in the least restrictive manner consistent with the requirements of the person in accordance with the court's commitments order. Now here, how would you interpret that so that you give the department the broad discretion you say it has under the statute?
Well, I do think that it's left to the court based on reports of the physicians, and in this case there was a report in the nature of a pre-sentence also, and that the court makes the decision about whether to place the person in institutional care or other supervised release. And then the department is to determine the level of security within that placement. Now, if the committee disagrees with that, then I think they can petition the court to... But it would be based on whether or not there was some abusive.
Now here,
doesn't that suggest that the state has facilities that it can decide between when placing the defendant? And here they don't have the facility.
Well, they didn't have the facility for this particular individual, but there are facilities in the state that can handle some of these sex predators. Now, I mean, I don't think that if every one of them was ordered under supervised release, they would be able to handle that, but they certainly can handle some supervised release.
The record indicates one facility added in Dane County at an 18-month waiting list. Is that your understanding of the facilities that you're referring to in the state of Wisconsin?
I don't know that that's the only one, but that's
in
the
this
one
record,
that's frequently mentioned.
In this record, that was mentioned as the only facility in the state of Wisconsin willing to take sexual offenders, addict in Dane County with an 18-month waiting list. Is that your understanding of the state
of
the
record? On this record, yes.
Let me tell you what's bothering me in this case and see if you can help me. The statute, 908-6-2B, mentions supervised release as an alternative. In C, it mentions supervised release as an alternative. In D, it mentions supervised release as an alternative. The Carpenter decision, when it discussed this portion of the opinion, relied on supervised release. On page 267, it was mentioned two times. On page 268, the necessity of having supervised release as an available option was mentioned three times. On the next page, it was mentioned two times. I think it accurate to state that having treatment available was the underpinning of the saving of the constitutionality of that statute. And now we're faced with a case that, at least according to the trial judge, Judge Becker, who says, look, there are doctors, the prosecutor, the defense, and this court believes there should be community treatment. But department, you're saying none is available. And none is available because of the articles that the trial court referred to, because of community pressure in large part, the death threats that Mr. Patrick got, the threats that the landlord got. Seems to me that for this person, as Mr. Patrick testified, there is no supervised release possible in the state of Wisconsin, and that the emphasis placed in Carpenter on the availability of supervised release and the emphasis placed on the statute are legal fictions. Respond to that.
Well, I can't deny that's certainly what the court did in Carpenter. I would point out, however, that the United States Supreme Court, in the absence of any possibility of supervised release, upheld the constitutionality of the Kansas statute.
Kansas statute didn't make reference to the kind of treatment or least restrictive language that we have in the statute of Wisconsin.
Well, that's true, but I guess my point is that while the statute may make a preference, may refer to supervisory release, and Mr. Castillo may have a statutory right to that as provided, I don't think one can conclude, at least facially, that there's a constitutional right to it.
Are you conceding a statutory violation here?
No, but not on this record. I mean, I would concede that the statute makes a provision for supervisory release, and that under the appropriate evidence, it can be a violation to not order it. I don't think this record makes it.
But the way you seem to be reading the statute, Mr. Weinstein, when I'm referring to 980.06 sub 2 sub B, you seem to add the word available into it. Every argument that I hear, the words of the statute is, the department shall arrange for controlled care treatment of the person in the least restrictive manner consistent with requirements. And in this case here, the facts seem to say, to me anyway, that the Department of Health and Social Services comes back to the court and says, we've got nothing available in supervised release. And you're defending that position. And that seems to me that you're adding in the word, in the least restrictive manner available.
Well,
to the extent that, and I do read the statute as having a preference, perhaps even a restriction to the community, the county of residence, and to the extent that, as I read the statute, it requires the department to use the facilities in the county of residence, that may be correct.
Let me ask you, because we give deference, at least to fact-finding by trial courts, and you have argued to us that the trial court has the option of deciding whether it ought to be a community placement or a facility placement. And Judge Becker, on page 136 of the record, while before she made her ultimate findings to place Mr. Castillo in the institution, said, "At this time, the least restrictive level of treatment is the resource center. I think because several entities have collaborated to reduce the alternatives. But I'm not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. The law is constitutional. The level of care has been sabotaged, and we will proceed from there." What do we do with that?
Well, I think that the sabotage she was referring to is the private action that's in the record and that's been referred to here previously.
And the several entities.
Threats that were made to the...
Who's the several entities?
Right. To the extent that the department sabotaged it, and you may be able to find some references that she makes to that, I don't think that's supported by the record.
Is that supported by her finding of contempt of the department?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so at all.
Mr. Weinstein, what's the relationship between a finding of a person being a sex predator and the Sex Offender Notification Act? Does one follow from the other? If you're found to be a sex predator, does the department have to notify the neighborhood, notify the community of placement?
Prior to release, yes, I believe so.
And that's even in a community-based treatment situation.
Yeah, I would say yes, that's right. And it's also for discharge.
Mr.
Counsel, I just, maybe you may want to do it anyway. You've got about 5 minutes left, and I would like you to address the Neely issue, which you raised in your cross petition.
Right. Well, my understanding of result would support, I suppose, Mr. Finley's argument. But when you read result, also with mandate and decision, I have to question whether result can be read that broadly. There's no way I think you can read mandate as being and in this case, the court didn't decide it against him. It didn't decide it at all. And I don't see how you could possibly read the mandate to cover that. And I don't think you can read decision either. Now, result, I would concede, if result was by itself, then it would probably encompass what Mr. Finley advocates. And frankly, I'm kind of two minds of this. I mean, I think probably the state would benefit as much as Mr. Finley's client.
Well, let me pursue that, because in fact I've got that part of your brief underlined. What kind of rule would you set out if you were sitting on this bench and could rewrite Neely? We've already got Mr. Finley's suggestion, which strikes me as opening up a door as wide as...
I guess if I were sitting on the bench, I would reaffirm Neely and I would remove the word result. I think the Neely decision, while it probably hurts the state as much as it does the defendants, makes a lot of sense from the standpoint of the court, not necessarily from the standpoint of the litigants. But I think that if you don't read it that way, it seems to me that the state's entitled to petition on any harmless error decision. I also think in the civil area, what if a plaintiff, a tort plaintiff, is awarded actual damages and loses on punitives? Now, is that petitionable?
Let me ask you about my example. Let's assume a defendant, after sentencing, files a 97406 motion, and it's heard, and there are two grounds. One is a new trial for something that happened during trial, and the other is for something that happened during sentencing. So they're asking for alternative relief. They go to the Court of Appeals, and the mandate is reverse and remanded, and technically the reverse and remand is on the sentencing portion, and in the body of the decision, it reaffirms the judgment of conviction. your position is that Neely would not allow a review on the denial for a new trial.
No, and I think the defendant can revisit his motion to suppress in the trial court. And if the same result occurs and he's again convicted, then he can raise that.
Well, he wouldn't if there's an affirmation of the all he wins on is the resentencing and not the new trial.
I'm sorry.
The example I gave you was that he lost his motion for new trial, but won at the Court of Appeals on resentencing. So it was reversed and remanded for resentencing.
Oh, for resentencing.
But not on the trial issue. I changed it from the first example that I gave Mr. Finley.
Well, I think he still can't petition. He goes back for resentencing. If he doesn't like the sentence, then he can come up again.
But can he petition for the Court of Appeals affirming the motion for new trial on constitutional grounds?
Well,
so
I
gets a remand on sentencing, but he loses on the trial issue.
Yes, but
a proper mandate for the Court of Appeals would be conviction, judgment of conviction affirmed, semicolon, sentence vacated.
Well, that's a question. If it's all those reasons, or it says
if that's the mandate, then I think it is adverse.
But if it says reversed and remanded,
that's right. Then it's not.
Well, but
so and there are cases, I think, where the wording of by the Court of Appeals could make a difference, and that's probably one of them. But if it's just reversed and remanded, that's not adverse. If it's judgment affirmed, sentence vacated, reversed and remanded with directions to resentence, then I think the mandate is adverse.
Well, that's just the ordinary Wednesday morning, 11 o'clock. We will proceed. Counsel, I'm going to just say this because I'm going to, at the end of this argument, ask each of you to, within the next 5 days, if you would check with your colleagues. I know that your colleagues at the Attorney General's office keep records and statistics and those and LAIP and the public defender do on response to the questions raised by the court on Neely.
Would like you to
tell us if you find any examples that support either position.
I'm sure we have harmless error.
No. The examples given were where there is a partial win by one of the sides in the ultimate outcome of the case.
Where the court accepted the petition?
Yes, and the court accepted or denied the petition on the ground that Neely has not been satisfied. I'm sure you can find many where there's been a conviction affirmed and the state doesn't like part of the decision relating to a substantive issue, and the court will not take that case. I'm sure you'll find that.
And I don't think we petitioned on those anymore.
And that was Neely.
Yes,
Neely was a conviction affirmed, and the state didn't like the opinion. Okay, your time has expired. Thank you, Mr. Weinstein.
Thank you very much.
Letter briefs will do. Letter memoranda.
Thank you. I wanted to return very briefly to the constitutional argument because I think, Justice Bradley, the points you made, troubles you had are very valid concerns. And I want to explain a little bit further about what the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Hendricks does to that. The Kansas statute was different because it expressly did not rely on treatment to the extent that the Wisconsin statute does. And that was an important factor. This was a 5-4 decision. The critical swing vote in the court was Justice Kennedy. And in his concurrence, what he wrote, 177 Supreme Court at 2087, was, if the object or purpose of the Kansas law had been to provide treatment, but the treatment provisions were adopted as a sham or mere pretext, there would have been an indication of the forbidden purpose to punish. So what we have is Justice Kennedy, the critical swing vote, telling us that if you set up a statute that's premised extensively on treatment, and you make promises of treatment, and then you don't follow through, the statute looks punitive and therefore is unconstitutional. And I would submit that that is precisely what we have in the case before the court today. I also want to make brief reference to the state's argument that the court cannot consider the least restrictive environment when deciding where to place the individual. It seems to me that reading of the statute really does turn the statute on its head and makes no sense. because it is the court only that can make the decision whether the individual is in custody or out of custody. The department can't make that decision. Even if the department feels the individual is ready to be released to the community, the department has to go back to the court to get an order releasing the individual on supervised release. It is that in custody versus supervised release decision where the least restrictive means requirement has real meaning.
Mr. Fenley, do you find any support in the legislative history for your position on that statutory section?
To be honest, I'm not aware of that. But I do think the legislation itself, I mean, on its face, I think it makes sense to be read that way also. The statute says the court decides in-out. Then it goes on in the last sentence to say the department shall arrange for control, care, and treatment of the person in the least restrictive manner consistent with the requirements of the person and in accordance with the court's commitment order. So the statute, by its own, in its own terms, references the least restrictive setting back to the court's commitment order. It would make no sense at all to read that as saying the trial court can't even consider this. Only the department can, but the department can't make the important decision based on that. Moreover, it seems to me that even if this court were to find that the trial court cannot consider the least restrictive means requirement, that would determine the outcome of this case, because what is clear is that the court in this case, the trial